Welcome to Cultural Baggage. This is Dean Becker, along with Steve Nolan, our producer and reporter. We're bringing you the unvarnished truth about the drug war. A little bit later, we'll have Judge James P. Gray, and we'll hear from National Normal about what you can do for medical marijuana patients. Much of tonight's news was gathered by the Campaign for the Restoration and Regulation of Hemp. You can access their website at www.crrh.org. First in the news, Milton Friedman on drugs. Shortly before his 90th birthday, later this month, and in honor of his lifetime achievements, President Bush invited Nobel laureate Milton Friedman to the White House. Calling him a hero of freedom, Bush praised the economist's contribution to American liberty, especially his advancement of a moral vision, the vision of a society where men and women are free, free to choose, but where government is not as free to override their decisions. Bush said, Milton Friedman has shown us that when government attempts to substitute its own judgments for the judgment of free people, the results are usually disastrous. A quote from Mr. Friedman, there is a surefire way to predict the consequences of a government social program adopted to achieve worthy ends. Find out what the well-meaning, public-interested persons who advocated its adoption expected it to accomplish, then reverse those expectations. You will have an accurate prediction of the actual results. Friedman also opposes the drug war for its fetters on individual freedom. Another quote from him. On ethical grounds, we do have a right to use the machinery of a government to prevent, or he asked, do we have the right to use the machinery of a government to prevent an individual from becoming an alcoholic or a drug addict? For children, almost everyone would answer at least a qualified yes. But for responsible adults, I, for one, would answer no. Reason with the potential addict, yes. Tell him the consequences, yes. Pray for and with him, yes. But I believe that we have no right to use force, directly or indirectly, to prevent a fellow man from committing suicide, let alone from drinking alcohol or taking drugs. A secret U.S. biofarms experiment is growing. Experimental plants engineered to produce pharmaceuticals are being grown at over 300 secret locations nationwide, a new report has revealed. Biotechnology firms are conducting experiments with corn, soy, rice, and tobacco that are genetically manipulated to produce drugs designed to act as vaccines, contraceptives, to induce abortions, generate growth hormones, or create blood clots. Just think, one mistake by a biotech company and we'll be eating someone else's prescription in our cornflakes. The California Supreme Court has backed medical marijuana. Californians who use or grow marijuana for personal medical use are protected from prosecution in state court as long as they have a doctor's approval, the Supreme Court decided unanimously on Thursday. In its first review of the medical marijuana initiative, which was approved by voters in 1996, the court said a medical user who is arrested can get the charges dismissed without a trial if the patient has a note on a prescription pad or any other evidence of a doctor's approval. The drug policy chief looks to the root of addiction. White House Drug Policy Director John P. Walters called on scientists yesterday to develop new tools for diagnosing and treating drug addiction, saying that major advances in genetics and neuroscience could help devise medicines that attack the root causes of substance abuse. Speaking at a substance abuse conference in Cambridge, Walters, director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy, said science must play a role in meeting President Bush's goal of a 10% reduction in drug abuse within 2 years and a 25% cut over 5 years. He said the administration has doubled federal spending on drug abuse research to $933 million, financing work at 10 locations nationwide. Walters said, drug addiction is a disease of the brain. Let me think about that. A disease of the brain. Ukraine. We decided long ago that decades behind prison bars was inhumane and totally inappropriate, that treatment and compassion were more appropriate for other types of mental illness, yet the lies and the pouring of hundreds of billions down the drain continues, thanks to those like Mr. Walters. The people waging the war on drugs have gone to Hollywood. Officials of the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration brief producers, directors, and writers on a connection between drug trafficking and terrorism to offer to consult on movies and television programs. About 40 people, including film directors like Michael Mann and Arthur Hiller, and people behind TV series such as Third Watch and ER, gathered at the Beverly Hills Hotel Wednesday for several hours to hear DEA Director Asa Hutchison, as well as the agency's intelligence chief and a former undercover agent. Lord knows what these guys will do, but with a legacy like Scarface and the eternal Miami Vice reruns, we can be certain that the young, the black, and the brown will be further demonized. This afternoon, I spoke with a representative from Normal. I'm speaking with Paul Armentano, the publications and research director for Normal. How are you doing, Paul?
Very good, thank you.
Yes, sir. I understand that this coming Wednesday, July 24th, Representatives Barney Frank and Ron Paul are trying to bring people's attention to a matter being brought before the House. Can you tell me what that's about?
Sure. Representatives Barney Frank and Ron Paul are co-sponsors of House Bill 2592, otherwise known as the States' Rights to Medical Marijuana Act. What that act would do, it would amend federal law and reschedule marijuana so that states that wish to legalize the medical use and distribution of medical marijuana would be free to do so. There are currently 36 co-sponsors to this legislation, but despite the fact that national polls tell us that 3 out of 4 Americans support this legislation, Congress has unfortunately been silent on this issue. What we intend to do, and what Representatives Frank and Paul intend to do at this press conference this coming Wednesday, is to once again reiterate to Congress that the American public supports this and that seriously ill patients who need medical marijuana can't wait any longer on this issue, and that it's time for Congress to get serious, hold hearings on this bill, and eventually pass a version of this bill.
Thank you, Paul. I see a strong correlation in this impasse to what's happened in New York State with the Rockefeller drug laws, where both the legislature and the governor proclaimed the need for change, and yet it hasn't come about yet.
Right. There are some similarities there. Certainly, polls tell us also in New York City that New York residents and New York State residents do support such a change, yet for whatever reason, legislators in that state often drag their heels. Congress is very much doing the same thing. Unfortunately, it's even more precarious because, unlike the case in New York State, where you do have high-ranking officials that talk the talk but actually then refuse to walk the walk, in Congress, unfortunately, too many high-ranking officials, particularly those in the Bush administration, actually try and maintain a position that marijuana does not have medicinal value and seem recalcitrant to move on this issue, despite the fact that scientific evidence and the will of the American public says otherwise.
I couldn't agree more. I saw a piece, I think, in The Guardian this past week where they spoke of the fact that in Great Britain, the studies came out and they actually paid attention to what they said, whereas here in the U.S. we've turned askance and failed to look at the results, which the studies we paid millions of dollars for indicate.
Yeah, it's not surprising. Governments, not even just ours, but ours certainly, have a history of ignoring federally commissioned reports that draw conclusions that are the opposite of what the party line is. And it's no surprise that the American government has done that as well. They did that in 1999 with the Institute of Medicine report that strongly spoke out in favor of the medical use of marijuana, particularly by seriously and terminally ill patients. That report also strongly encouraged the federal government to set up ASAP, human clinical trials on the drug. That was not done, even though that recommendation could have been implemented very quickly. And similarly, if you want to talk about the broader issue of decriminalization of marijuana for recreational use, our own Congress back in 1972 commissioned the Schaefer Commission to look at that issue. They came back that year and said, as a national policy, we should remove the threat of criminal arrest for the possession, use, and nonprofit transactions of marijuana. That report was also summarily ignored.
Hey, Paul, can you tell us where my listeners might be able to fax or email their congressman in support of this bill?
And in fact, we would encourage many of your listeners to do so. As I said, we do have 36 co-sponsors currently who are signed on to this legislation. We would love for listeners to encourage their own elected officials, if they are not currently a co-sponsor on board with this issue, to be on board, and if they are a co-sponsor, to consider attending this important press conference next week. If they go to our website at www.normal.org, they will be prompted right at the homepage to click on a separate section where they can then get a list of co-sponsors. They can find out who their representative in Congress is, and they can fax or email them a pre-written letter addressing this issue and addressing the coming press conference.
I want to alert you to a couple of things that next week at this same time we will have The Other Side featuring Glenn Urbaugh. We do have Judge James Gray on the line. Judge Gray, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, and good evening, Steve.
This is Dean, but thank you, sir. Welcome to Cultural Baggage. I understand that you were in Canada last month at the Unitarian Universalist Association as they broke new ground in drug policy reform. Could you tell us about that event, sir?
Well, Dean, I certainly can, and I'm really deeply proud of these folks. This is a national organization, obviously. They met in Quebec. They had a statement of conscience that, in effect, literally decried the war on drugs, and they took positions that it's failed, and we must affirmatively explore options. I was proud to be able to go and talk with them prior to their vote, and we stirred it up a little bit and discussed the matter really openly and honestly. They voted their conscience, and they took a big step forward. I think we all have a right to be proud of them.
Yes, sir. As I understand it, they want to establish a legal regulated market, tax marijuana, and treat it as we would alcohol.
That's right. That's right. And I think that is an extremely good idea, one that eventually the country will do. We should control it. You know, Dean, as you know, the whole term controlled substance is probably the biggest oxymoron we have going on in our country today.
Most certainly.
These substances are less controlled than almost anything we can think of. So we want to bring them back under the law. We want to control them. We want to make them available for only adults. We want to be able to keep people from having to be criminals in order to deal with this. We want to tax it, and we want to control it. And eventually, it will happen. I think that the Unitarians took a big step forward in that goal.
Yes, sir. We can only hope that other churches will follow suit as well. The way I understand it, they even want to remove criminal penalties for possession of other illegal drugs, such as, cocaine or heroin, and actually arrest people only when they've committed an actual crime against society.
Well, Dean, I've been involved in the criminal justice system pretty much all my professional life. I've been a judge here in Orange County in California for about 18 years. The criminal justice system simply cannot address this issue. When we approved that, we have filled our nation's prisons with low-level nonviolent drug offenders, and still the drugs are more available now than ever before. So I think that they are right. I think that you are right. We have to address what people do, what their actions are. But to be honest with you, Ronald Reagan said it best of all people in this circumstance. And he said that it is the true function of government to have it protect us from each other, and I think he's absolutely right. But where government goes astray, he said, is where government tries to protect us from ourselves. What we put into our bodies cannot be controlled by the government. In doing so, we've set up an unbelievably lucrative illegal market, just like an alcohol prohibition, but now it's about 64 times worse. So let's bring these drugs back under the law and hold people accountable for what they do. That's what the Unitarian Universalist said. That's certainly what I say as well, and a lot of normal, reasonable people around the country, Milton Friedman, George Shultz, Walter Cronkite, and numbers of others.
Yes, sir. This is true. I want to inform our listeners, we are speaking to Superior Court Judge James P. Gray. He is the author of Why Our Drug Laws Have Failed and What We Can Do About It, a judicial indictment of the war on drugs. We'll be asking for our listeners to call in here in a few moments. Our number here is 713-526-5738. Judge Gray, I know that you're a very busy man, that you try to stay involved in this reform movement, that you actually travel the world in this effort. Could you tell us what you and San Ho Tree have done with Mr. Stossel and what we can expect on ABC on the 30th of this month?
Well, Dean, yes. I have been working with John Stossel, who's a very gifted fellow, with ABC News, and they're going to have an ABC News special on Tuesday, the 30th of July, just not too far away, at 10 o'clock in the evening in most areas, 9 o'clock Central Time.
Mm-hmm.
And these folks really have gotten into this. So their producers know more about this than any people in the media I've worked with. These people have traveled to England, to Holland, to Colombia with San Ho Tree. They have gone to Detroit. I toured actually in the Bronx with a Catholic priest who's very familiar with the neighborhood, pointing out different places that they've had machine gun fire and other drug dealers trying to shoot it out with various competitors, all of which is totally unnecessary and totally caused by our laws of drug prohibition. So please ask your listeners to look into this show. It'll be hard-hitting, it'll be factual, and it'll help us address the various difficulty that we're facing here, mostly caused by our present laws. So drug prohibition just doesn't work, and almost literally, progress is being defined in drug prohibition laws as slowing down the pace of defeat. It's failed, it is hopeless, and it will only get better, just like alcohol prohibition, when we finally repeal it and bring the drugs back under the law.
Yes, I know you that I've heard you mention in the past that the drug prohibitionists, the drug warriors, must have marijuana illegal just because of the bulk of the cases that involve marijuana to justify and keep the balance and ongoing effort to their drug war.
Well, Dean, I'm sorry to say that I believe that very deeply. Probably of all drugs that are used, illegal drugs in our society, 75% is marijuana, and if we were to take those out, if we were to somehow bring those back under the law, have a strictly regulated control and distribution of them, tax them, but make them available for adults in the circumstance, we would probably then have so few people using or abusing these other drugs that it simply flat out would not justify this enormous bureaucracy that is spread up in what I call the prison industrial complex to address all of these other drugs combined. And people would realize that it just is bloated, out of control, and must be repealed. You know, Dean, every federal agency we have gets extra money each year earmarked in its budget to fight the war on drugs. And if you're looking for them to be reasonable about this, talk sense, you'll never find it, because they're addicted to this money. It is up to us as taxpayers, voters, citizens, to stand up and say, no, there's got to be a better way. Let's change this failed system, and then we'll begin to make some progress.
Well, this tapping into the public fund that you speak of, it ranges from mailmen to forest rangers to gosh only knows what, all these people that are addicted, as you say.
Oh, yeah. It's everywhere. It's not only the obvious ones. I mean, the Department of State is obvious, the Bureau of Customs, obviously all of the military. But, you know, Dean, it's the little guys, too. It's the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Department of Agriculture, the Bureau of Land Management. All of these agencies also get extra tens of millions, if not more, of dollars each year in their budget, expressly earmarked to fight the war on drugs. So it is pervasive, it's pernicious, and it's time for us, again, as the taxpayers and the voters, to stand up and say no. This is the definition of a grassroots movement, and we need our citizens to stand up and say, wait a minute, you know, enough is much too much. It's time to change this.
Yes, right. I try to, you know, entice my readers to get involved, to contact Normal here in town, or to contact the Drug Policy Forum of Texas, but that the time is at hand. The drug warriors have no more ammunition of, you know, moral posturing or whatever. It's just ancient superstition they bandy about at this time.
Well, you're right. All we need to do is to legitimize the discussion. All we need to do is let people realize that it's okay to talk about drug policy. Just because we do so does not at all mean that we condone drug use or abuse. In fact, I hate these drugs so much, I want to change our system to reduce the harm that's going to be caused from them. Because as soon as people realize what's happening and they feel empowered enough to discuss it openly, I promise you they will absolutely want to stand up in unison, shake their fists and say, no, we've got to change this, we've got to repeal drug prohibition. Because of the all incredible benefits that will be accruing from that. Now, I was listening to you before I came on, and that every neutral study we've had in our country for the last 100 years has recommended the same thing. They have said, get away from the criminal justice system, go to some form of decriminalization or regulation because of the incredible benefits that will accrue, just like when we repealed alcohol prohibition. You know, crime went down nationwide. It plummeted. After we repealed alcohol prohibition, it went down for about 11 straight years, and the same thing is going to happen when we finally repeal drug prohibition. Those are just things that we know will happen. We just have to get at it.
Yes, sir. I reached back a couple of months to the drug conference at Rice University, the Baker Institute, and I realized that, you know, of the approximate 100 people on a daily average that showed up, there would be one representative from the other side. They just don't have the ammunition. I know in reading your book, there have been many judges across America that have taken a stance, either refusing to try certain types of cases or speaking openly and publicly about ending this drug war. Have you run into any more of your associates that are now seeing the light?
Well, Dean, that's true. In fact, as you said, the subtitle of my book is Judicial Indictment of the War on Drugs. I quote something like 40 judges from around the country, in fact, some are from Texas, that say that what we're doing isn't working. They use their own experience and their thoughts as to what we should do instead. And since then, of course, what you're asking is really two questions. So what do judges tell me quietly and privately in the judges' lunchroom, in the elevators, and almost all of them agree with me that what we're doing isn't working. Now, whether you're going to talk to them publicly about that, regretfully, is a different thing, just like pretty much with all or many of our elected representatives in Washington or elsewhere. They pretty much realize it, but they need the political cover. They need to know that if they discuss this sensibly, that they won't be voted out of office. And that's where we come in. Now, that's where you and your listeners and I and all the rest of us come in. We need to assure our elected officials that not only will they not be kicked out of office if they speak reasonably about this, they need to know that they'll be kicked out of office if they don't speak reasonably about this.
Yes, sir. One last thought before we reach out to our callers. I was wanting your take on what you think of, I think it was yesterday's California Supreme Court ruling in regards to medical marijuana.
Well, hooray.
Yes, sir.
California Supreme Court spoke. They spoke unanimously. They were a voice of reason, finally, that yes, Proposition 215 in California for medical marijuana is good law, it's now constitutional law, and people that have a recommendation from a medical doctor will not be prosecuted. And all they have to do is show that, and in fact, at that point, that case can be kicked out of the criminal justice system. Hooray for that.
Yes, sir. Okay. I want to alert the callers that we will be taking your calls. We're going to take a short break. Please give us a call, 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-5738. We do have a caller. Randy, do you hear me?
Yes, sir, I do.
Do you have a question for Judge Gray?
Well, sir, I wanted to ask. It's so very difficult for myself. I'm a young man, 34 years old, And I have two children, and I do use marijuana recreationally. I have to hide it from them, and I really don't like that. And I don't understand how that, like my family can have beer all around and even become drunk and disorderly. And to be honest, when I smoke marijuana, I do not become that way, you know. It makes no sense to me.
Randy, it doesn't make any sense to me either. If we were back in 1930 or 1932, I pretty much, and I'll disclose to you publicly, pretty much every day after work, I come home and use a mind-altering substance, sometimes addicting substance. Namely, I have a glass of wine with dinner.
Yes, sir.
If I were to do that in 1932, what I did would have been illegal. What you are doing would not have been illegal. The properties of these substances have not changed. However, I've got to tell you, you know, society is pretty merciless, and you have to be careful.
Yes, sir.
Because this is illegal, and we could have the feds or your local police seizing your property and putting you in jail and doing some bad stuff.
Yes, sir.
This is a bad thing that we are doing, and it grieves me. This is not like our country. This is not the United States of America that I know and love.
No, sir. I don't feel represented at all.
Well,
at all. And I've been working ever since I was 17 years old and paying taxes.
Okay. And Andy, I don't use this. I never have. I'm not interested in smoking things. However, I do believe rather deeply that marijuana is far less dangerous than alcohol. Nevertheless, we need people like you to legitimize the discussion. We need you to talk to your neighbors, your friends, your Rotary clubs, your religious groups, whatever you belong to get this on the front burner, to allow people to realize the truth. People in our country are good people. They want to do the right thing, but we're fighting with decades of rhetoric, and it goes way back. I have a chapter in my book, on history, and unfortunately, we made these various substances illegal for no reasons at all, dealing with health, dealing with safety, unfortunately had almost everything to do with racism, empire building, and fraud. But nonetheless, we've got them. We need to legitimize this discussion, take a look at what we're doing, and then we will change this. So that's where I would recommend you direct your activities, talk to your friends, talk to your neighbors, invite your local chief of police over to a group of folks, or your mayor or city council folks or whatever, and have them discuss this issue directly. And start with things like needle exchange. I mean, it's absolutely criminal not to have needle exchange in our facilities. It's criminal for people that are sick and wasting away on AIDS and are taking chemotherapy and have the nausea attached with it not to be able to have marijuana. It is an absolute crime.
So can I interrupt?
Tell our people the truth, and then we will change.
I want to interrupt one second to alert our listeners that we do have phone lines open. Please give us a call, 713-526-5738. Randy, I wanted to make a quick comment, too, about your situation as being a young father with children at home.
Yes, sir.
There was a recent story in the New York Times. I think it's still on their drug policy forum, which Judge Gray is familiar with. And I do want to thank you for joining us so many times there as well, sir. But there's a story there called Boomers in the Closet, something to that effect. And they have a great discussion about how to handle that situation of being a parent who smokes marijuana and how to deal with the children about it. I think
most certainly don't want to lie to my son.
No, sir. I would not recommend it.
No, I think that's the only thing to do is to be totally open and honest and say, unfortunately, that right now there are some people that don't agree with what that I do. Or something to that effect.
Well, Randy, too, you know, it's baffled me that I am basically a child of the 60s. Again, I've never used marijuana or any of these other drugs, but most people in my generation have. And you know the way that our folks, my generation, has responded to their use and even abuse of these drugs? We have responded by putting our children in jail, and it's something I have simply never understood. It's hypocrisy to the worst degree. But again, it's driven by fear and the unknown. We just need to stand up and address this stuff openly, and I guarantee you we will change away from this failed system.
I hope so. I spent some time as a foreign exchange student over in Europe, And the policies there, especially when I was in the Netherlands, was so much better. And the people that I came in contact with, I spoke with, and they said that actually, because that was there and it was decriminalized, that some people might use it, but then they just passed on and said, nah, yeah, I tried that, and then went on to their life.
That's true.
Yeah, well, I think
countries,
so.
Countries in Western Europe are more sophisticated, I think, in a lot of ways than we are. That they're addressing these as managers instead of moralists, and they realize that these drugs, dangerous as they can be sometimes,
yes,
are here to stay. So they try to manage them, they try to take the crime out of it, they try to take the underground market out of it, the unknown out of it. And they have, for example, in Holland or in the Netherlands, even though they're available for people that I think are 16 years of age or older at coffee shops and the rest, they actually have about half the marijuana usage in that country, both for teenagers as well as adults, that we do in our country. So I think what you're saying is absolutely right. If you take the glamour out of it, you take the profit motive out of it,
yes, sir,
you actually reduce the use of these drugs.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
Well, good luck to you. I do recommend that you do not tell things that are untrue to your son. That will only rebound harmfully.
Yes, sir.
But be careful, because at this moment, still, bad things can happen to you, even though you're using something a lot less dangerous than I use when I go home at night.
Yes, sir.
Thank
you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
Bye now. I recall there was a comment, I think today on Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman's show, where she spoke of the fact that men of Hispanic heritage are 13 times more likely to be arrested for a drug crime than the average white citizen, if you will.
Dean, it drives me crazy. You know, if any of your listeners have any question, all they have to do is go and visit any jail or prison in our country today, and who are they going to see? You know, they're not people like me. They're not Caucasian people. They are people of color. And this, again, is not what our country stands for. And it is absolutely outrageous. We must change that.
They call it racial profiling, but it's bigotry. I think
it's not designed that way, but it certainly has evolved that way. And this is an atrocity that we all need to stand up, shake our fists, and say, no, this will be no longer.
Yes, sir. We do have another caller. I'll get to that in just a second. I want to alert our listeners out there. Please call us, 713-526-5738. John, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Do you have a question for Judge Gray?
Yeah, I did have a question. You mentioned a few minutes ago to the last caller that it's our duty to, you know, get involved with our Rotary clubs or invite our mayor or chief of police over to our homes to have discussions about this. I think that's very easy to say when you come from a position of privilege. It's much easier for someone who is a judge or someone who's the CEO of a corporation to say, I disagree with the drug laws in the United States. The majority of people that are arrested for drug violations are not white-collar heads of companies. They're blue-collar workers. They're low-level managers in the white-collar areas. And it's much more difficult. They have a lot more at stake if they stand up and say that they're against it. It's like when you're wondering why there aren't more minorities involved in activism in any kind of area, especially the drug area. I mean, they have a lot more to lose. They're the ones that are arrested. They're the ones that are picked up. They're not picking up the CEOs of corporations. They're picking up the people who don't have the power to get the high-priced lawyers to defend themselves, to get themselves, you know, out of jail.
Okay, John, you know, I agree with you in part, and I really disagree with you in part. One reason, and again, I'm a pretty tough dude. I'm a conservative Republican in a conservative Republican area. And I looked at myself in the mirror and said, you know, Jim, who has the chance of getting a hearing on this? A public defender from Berkeley or a conservative Republican Superior Court judge from California? So I decided, yes, that I would have a much better time in getting people to listen to the message if I were to speak forward, and I have. On the other hand, you know, although I vote in every election, I just have one vote. And politicians, elected officials, will listen to people that are voters. And that includes everybody. That includes people that are minorities and people even that use drugs. I'm not saying you should come out and have a smoke-a-thon with your local mayor. I am saying, though, that if you can elect that person will listen to you. And if you can get a group of people together, be it a religious group or a alumni meeting from your local high school or your Rotary Club or whatever else, you get 20 and 30 people together that can actually elect that city council person, that city council person will listen to you. You have a lot more power than you think you do, and if you use it, you will be astounded at the results.
I think that that's a wonderful thing to say, but I don't think that that's proven to be correct. I mean, 215 has been law in California since 1996, yet until this decision, and who knows, maybe it'll go on after this decision with the Supreme Court of California, people are being picked up, not necessarily by California police, but that has been the case, but by federal authorities who are putting them in jail for the rest of their lives, or denying them access to the medicine that the state of California and the people of the state of California have said is acceptable for them to use. And several activists have died in prison because, you know, the nausea keeps them from being able to eat, and they have no access to the medication that is legal in the state of California, has been legal in the state of California since 1996 for them to have.
Well, yes, John, and once again, I agree with you in part and disagree. What you said is absolutely right, and it is awful, and people have died, and people are in prison for doing nothing more than smoking marijuana, and it goes on. And yes, Prop 215 was passed in 1996, and only now has the California Supreme Court come forward, although there's certainly been beneficial things from 215 since then. On the other hand, what are you going to do? Are you going to give up and just go to the beach? It is time for all of us to stand up and to take control. And we can do that. You know, in a democracy, we get the government that we deserve. We can sit back and whine and say, well, why doesn't somebody do something, and then not vote? And shame on us. We get the government we deserve. We're not doing a particularly good job of it. If we don't vote and elect our elected representatives, I assure you other people will. It's time that we take much more of a hand instead of sitting back and complaining and saying, oh, ain't it awful.
If I might interject one thought here, John, you talk about the little guy maybe not having the advantage or the capability. I'm pretty much a little guy. I mean, I sponsor the Cannabis Odysseys. I sponsor the events on the New York Times Drug Policy Forum. Basically, what I have is a telephone and an idea. And I've written everybody from the president to the governor on down to the mayor, the police chief, the district attorney, telling them that I no longer believe in their drug war and that I will no longer remain within the confines they try to define for me. And I got this radio show, and I stand proud of everything I've done. And you can do it. That's what I'm saying. The drug war is over. The day we decide it is over, and you can get involved. We do have a couple of other callers. We have some open lines. Please call us, 713-526-5738. John, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, we have, is it Slasher?
Hello?
Hello, Slasher.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good. Do you have a question for Judge Gray?
Yeah, you know, I wanted to say, you know, I've heard people say that right-wingers shouldn't be on Pacific Airways, and I just wanted to say that Judge Gray is a perfect example of how wrong those people are. The question I have is, if it was the case that to prohibit alcohol in this country, we had to amend the Constitution, why is it that they didn't amend the Constitution to outlaw drugs? Have the judicial greats, the great barristers of our land, figured out some new scam to pull on us, or what? I'll take my answer off there. Thank you.
Well, Slasher, it's hard for me to answer that question. It's true that in order to make alcohol illegal, we ended up passing a constitutional amendment, the 18th Amendment, to do that. And there has been an argument that, no, you can't make these various other mind-altering, sometimes addicting drugs illegal unless you would have a constitutional amendment as well for that effect. That has not proved to be the case. It has been argued. I'm not on the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has trumped it. So who knows? I am baffled constitutionally. Maybe we wouldn't have to have made a constitutional amendment to make alcohol illegal, but I don't know. That is something I am unable to answer for you. However, I can say that from my experience, and I've been involved in the criminal justice system for a very long time, it does work. It is responsive. Elective government is responsive as well. And this failed program of drug prohibition is on its way out. We have a lot of people in our country, and I'm proud of them, just like Dean, who is, as he says, you know, he has an idea, he's one person, and now look at him, and look what he's doing. We all can do that. We all have connections. We all can vote. We all have groups that we can activate. And as long as we sit by passively and bellyache and don't do anything, this failed system will continue. But as soon as we rise up and do what we really can and should do, it'll change. And it is changing. Look how quickly the Berlin Wall finally fell when it started to crumble. The same thing, in my view, is happening with regard to this failed policy of drug prohibition. So let's get at it. We can't do it yesterday, but we certainly, by thunder, can do it today.
Thank you, Judge. We do have another caller. We might have room for one more, 713-526-5738. Dave, are you on the line? Okay, Dave, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Go ahead, please.
Okay, I want to thank you for giving me the chance to speak, and thank Judge Gray for being on. I have some numbers I want to throw out for y'all. They may be common knowledge to a lot of people. They were rather new to me. My brother sent them to me, and I did have a question for his honor. But this is a typical year in the U.S. The tobacco kills 390,000 people. Alcohol kills 80,000. Secondhand smoke, 50,000. Cocaine, 2,200. Heroin, 2,000, aspirin, 2,000. There has never been a recorded death due to marijuana use at any time in U.S. history.
Dave, those are the numbers that I believe as well. If we are concerned about people taking a substance that will kill them, what we certainly should do is outlaw tobacco. There's no question about it. It dwarfs the harm it has caused to the user by any other drug. However, of course, if we were to do that, we'd make my wonderful 84-year-old mother a criminal. That is not the answer. We would result in more Al Capones pushing tobacco, of course, than ever before. We have to learn from that. So you're right. But if you're looking for consistency in the war on drugs and drug prohibition, you're looking in the wrong area.
Oh, I never looked for consistency with bureaucracy.
Okay.
But I did have a question for you. It talked about your comments about, you know, how we are going to need the change. And the thing that you finally hit that had been on my mind was the political aspect of it. How long do you believe it's going to be before a presidential candidate would have I want to say the courage. I'm sure they all have the courage, but they're none of them are dumb enough to stand up and say, I support decriminalization of marijuana, because that would be the last time they saw any glimpse of the ticket, I would think.
Well, you know, Dave, it's going to happen as soon as the politicians realize that the votes are there. Politicians, and I don't fault them for this. It's our system.
Right.
Politicians, elected officials, are great at followership. They will follow where the votes are. So our politicians today are absolutely apoplectic, terribly worried about being labeled as soft on crime. As a result, of course, they talk tough and they pass this tough stuff. What we really need, of course, is to have them be smart on crime instead of tough on crime, and then we start making progress. But I visit this at our doorstep. This is our fault, because we're the voters that elect and re-elect these people time and time again for talking tough and talking stupid. So as soon as they realize the votes are otherwise, then the politicians will be out in front leading the charge. And it's starting to happen.
Yeah, I would hope the media attention that I was just hearing about this coming up about the topic would broaden some of the acceptability of it. I think for so many years they've heard, you know, drugs kill, drugs kill. We spent all of our time teaching against it rather than focusing on what the problem is and what the problem isn't.
You know, you're absolutely right. Also, automobiles kill. Baseball bats have killed. You know, high cholesterol foods kill as well. I personally think that French fried potatoes and potato chips are very dangerous substances.
Dave,
people sniff gasoline too. Should we make gasoline illegal? These are things that we have to start grappling with. But when it comes down to it, and this is something that I wish people would focus on, it makes as much sense to me to put this gifted actor Robert Downey Jr. in jail for his drug abuse, and he clearly seems to have a cocaine problem, as it would have Betty Ford in jail for her alcohol abuse. It's really no different. What we need to do, as we had said earlier this evening, is hold people accountable for what they do. If they're going to drive a motor vehicle under the influence of, you name it, marijuana, alcohol, methamphetamines, bring them to me. That's a crime. But if they just put some of these substances into their body, what we need to do instead is work on things that actually are productive, namely drug treatment, drug education, and holding people accountable for what they do.
Dave, I want to thank you and all my callers. We have one more, Matthew. Can you hear us, Matthew?
I hear you, Dean.
Yes, you have a question for Judge Gray.
I do. I understand he helped to found an organization called Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, and I wonder if you could tell us a little more about it, its genesis, its founders, the sort of feedback he's been getting on it, and where we might learn more about it.
Matthew, actually, that sounds real good to me, but I think you've got the wrong fellow. I don't know what that program is, so I'm sorry. I wish I had. But that's not me.
Oh, okay, well, it's leap.cc, and I understand that Joe McNamara and I guess I'm just thinking of another judge in California who helped found it, and Sheriff Masterson were all involved in forming this group, and, well, I'm glad we were able to tell you about it. I was hoping you could tell me more about it.
Well, but, I gotcha.
Check it out, leap.cc on the web.
Let me, while we're on the subject, if people do, and I know we're running out of time, there's never enough time to talk about this. But if people want more information, Dean, if they could visit my website,
yes,
which is www.judgejimgray.com, Gray is G-R-A-Y, judgejimgray.com, they'll get more information. Actually, too, and I'll never get rich on selling books, but if they would be interested of why our drug laws have failed and what we can do about it, a judicial indictment of the war on drugs, it's published by Temple University Press, it's available. Use it for a discussion. I spent a lot of time talking about all of this, and the first half, I guarantee you, will make you very angry, because it talks about all the harms we've visited upon ourselves unnecessarily by this drug prohibition scheme. But the second half talks about options, and we have numbers of them. It will give you hope. It will show you what we can do that actually works. We'll make big-time progress once we can turn it around. And then, of course, if I can again, too, this ABC News special, Tuesday, the 30th of July, John Stossel, ABC News, that will be really hard-hitting, really interesting. I hope that all of your listeners give it a shot.
I think it's something they ought to alert their friends, their parents, their relatives about, that this is a moment that they should all be aware of.
Please do. You'll really get something sobering. They've gone a lot of places, and they've shown. You know, Dean, in my view, there are five groups of people that are winning the war on drugs.
Yes, sir.
And if I can quickly,
yes.
The first is, of course, the drug lords. They are obviously making tens of billions of dollars each year, and they appreciate it. But the second group are people in the bureaucracy that are paid to fight the drug lords. And they are, of course, expanding their fiefdoms and getting big-time money. The third group, rather obviously as well, are people that build prisons and staff them. And this is an industry that is growing phenomenally around our country. Our country leads the world in the incarceration of its people, and many of them are nonviolent drug offenders. The fourth group, as we've talked about most of the evening, are politicians. They get elected and reelected by talking tough in this and passing this tough but senseless legislation. And the fifth group, and people haven't thought about this so much, but it's certainly true, and that is the terrorists, the people like Osama bin Laden. Where do you think he gets his money to do these evil and cowardly deeds? You know, he gets them from drug prohibition. He gets them from the sale of illicit drugs. And as long as that demand is here in this country, that money will always be there. If we want to do something actively to fight terrorism, repeal the war on drugs, repeal drug prohibition, and then we will truly do something against terrorism, because these fanatics will still be out there, but with that funding, they'll be much, much less effective.
Judge Gray, I want to thank you for taking the time to stay up late with us tonight. It is my hope that at some future point I can begin putting together some panels, much like we did on the New York Times Forum, and that perhaps you will join us on one of those panels.
Happy to, Dean. I'm proud of you. Keep doing what you're doing.
Yes, sir, and you keep doing what you're doing. It's your book that inspired me to do many of the things I do that gave me the courage. And as one of our callers alluded to, it takes understanding that the problem can be solved, which your book clarifies for us, it can be done. And I thank you, sir.
Well, thank you. It made me proud. Appreciate it.
Yes, sir.
Good luck to us all.
You bet.
Good night.
Good night.
This is Mark Greer, Executive Director of Drug Sense. You're listening to Cultural Baggage on 90.1 KPFT in Houston. To end the drug war, visit mapinc.org. That's mapinc.org. Get active, stay aware, stay informed.